years in an earlier part of his career, and has worked with the Ute Mountain Tribal Negotiating Team for Colorado Indian Water Rights Settlement in the 80s, and as a project development coordinator for the Tribal Farm and Ranch Enterprise, and so has a really vast wealth of knowledge in working on water issues and tribal water rights specifically. So with that, I'll turn it over. We're going to do some question and answer throughout, so feel free to jot down any questions you have and ask them when there's a good time, and hopefully a little bit at the end as well. So thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
All right, well, appreciate the opportunity to be here today and to talk with you. And what I'm going to try to do, rather than kind of give you a never-ending PowerPoint show, is really kind of open it up for questions at various points. So if you're in the room here, just all you got to do is raise your hand. If you're at CSU and you raise your hand on the, you know, kind of virtually, then I'll get a signal that, I mean, we'll take your questions. So yeah, if we can make this a little bit interactive, I think that's always more fun than, you know, just hearing a straight up presentation. All right. So just as introduced, in addition, I'm president of the Wenatchee Development Corporation, and everything that we manage was really a result of the Colorado Ute Indian Water Rights Settlement. As you'll see as I go through my presentation, the tribe has a 7,700 acre farm. The community of Toyoak got drinking water for the first time in their history. And then there's a substantial economic development, and we'll kind of address that. And so one of the pleasures of being president of the Development Corporation Board. I can see all the things that came to fruit as a result of the tribe, you know, having potable water. My other role that's where a lot of this is going to come from. I'm a water resources advisor to the tribe. And we're in the process right now of putting together a water resources. We're doing a strategic plan, water resources plan, and forming a water resources department here, which we'd like to get going kind of early in the year. So that's kind of the backstory. So what I'll try to do is I'll start, you know, with a kind of Colorado River Basin tribal perspective. In other words, more broadly, I mean, the two Colorado tribes are certainly part of the Colorado River Basin. There are actually 30 tribes involved. I'm going to talk a little bit about the, you know, there's a coalition of tribes of 10 tribes, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Then I'm going to kind of tell you what came out of the Colorado Ute Indian Water Rights Settlement, and then some of the settlement water uses that have resulted in some of the challenges that we've faced, particularly in this current period of drought and shortage. And then, you know, we've also, the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe has land in New Mexico and Utah. We were one of the very early settlements in the country with settling our Colorado rights, but there's also, and that's how I kind of got my start in the water world as part of the tribe's negotiating team. But we still got ahead, you know, efforts to settle in New Mexico and Utah, and I'll talk about that a little bit. And then relationship building. I mean, given where we're at right now and all the challenges that we face within the Colorado River Basin, it's going to be essential that we work together. So I'll kind of do some broad outlines about how that's playing out. So this, I mentioned the tribal coalitions, the 10 tribes partnership. You can see the tribes depicted on the map. It was formed in 1992 to really try and increase the influence of tribes on Colorado River Basin water management. I mean, if you think back on the history of this, the Colorado River Compact was put together in 1922. The fact that the tribes had water rights, you know, that were relevant was well recognized. In fact, the chairman of the commission, Herbert Hoover, mentioned the fact that the tribes had winter rights claims, but they did not include the tribes in those discussions. Then there was the agreements and the commission that were put together. Tribes were not included at that point. So really this was an important step forward in terms of the tribes joining together and trying to use their mutual influence to open the door to their participation. And as you'll hear, substantial progress has been made up to this point. So reclamation, Bureau of Reclamation, they're trying to figure out what to expect within the Colorado River Basin. They have their water studies, their models and everything. And again, the tribes were never incorporated into those models. And that was one of the things that the 10 Tribes Partnership pushed for, was inclusion of the tribes in the modeling that's going on. And so as it turns out, so Reclamation agreed to do a tribal water rights study, which was completed in at the end of 2018. And it concluded the tribes have 2.8 million acre feet of unresolved water rights claims. So tribes have a big, they're holding a large amount of undeveloped water within the Colorado River Basin. The tribes need, they need legal quantification of their water rights. And so that's what everybody is working on. Again, we were fortunate in Colorado because we got one of the early settlements. But, you know, we're as I said, we're still looking at, still working with New Mexico and Utah. And the other tribes up and down the Colorado River are struggling, you know, kind of with the same thing. And then the other thing is the tribes need infrastructure to access and use their water rights. When we were really organizing the settlement negotiations back in the 1980s, the tribal leadership told me, we want wet water. And that's an important distinction, is the difference between paper water and wet water. You can have a paper water right that says, yes, you're entitled or you're decreed this amount of water as a tribe. But if you don't have a use to, you know, to put it, if you don't have a way to use it and you don't have the infrastructure to move the water to its point of use, then you've got you're basically holding a paper water right. And so the tribes are really, that's how the basically being able to access and use the water rights and have the infrastructure to do so is really the basis for wet water and for taking a paper water right and making it real and making it a water source that the tribes can use. And then the other thing that the 10 Tribes Partnership has been really firm on is their need for representation in basin management decisions. I mean, right now, I won't go into a lot of the details. I mean, you may, unless people have questions about it, but there's what's called the interim agreement that really determines how water gets divvied up between the upper and lower basin. And, you know, we're in the upper basin, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and part of New Mexico. And then the lower basin is primarily Nevada, California, Arizona. So how the water gets divvied up between the upper and lower basin, there was an interim agreement on how water essentially gets moved from Lake Powell, you know, down to Lake Mead. And that's all up for renegotiation beginning in 2026. So the guidelines that have been in place have been under severe stress because they were really developed before we knew how acute the water shortages were going to turn out to be. And so the tribes are very much interested in being a part of these management decisions. I just came back from a meeting with Becky Mitchell, who's our commissioner and head of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, and the door is opening. I mean, she is finding mechanisms for tribes to be involved in these discussions. In fact, we're going to start to get some draft proposals here over the next few weeks as to how that might work. Any questions? I'm going to shift now gears and talk about the Ute Mountain settlement. Are there any questions about what I've covered so far, pertaining to, broadly to tribal water rights in the Colorado River Basin? And then, the importance of starting to get those water rights recognized, incorporated and quantified. Okay. I'm just giving you an opportunity, so I'm not kind of just droning on. All right. So then Colorado Ute Indian Water Rights Settlement was initially agreed to or signed off in 1986, and it was legislated by Congress in 1988. I mean, there's a law establishing this settlement. That was my introduction to water. I served on the Ute Mountain Ute Water Rights Negotiating Team, and that got me kind of into the water world. I eventually became a water manager, and so a really important first step in my career. So what I'm showing you here, I mean, one of the keys to the Ute portion of the settlement was around this concept of wet water. So what you're looking at here, these great, you know, the green lands, is there a pointer on this thing? Or I mean, I don't really probably need one.
Let's see.
Well, man, this is really uptown. I like this. This Fort Lewis. I worked for Fort Lewis for 25 years, by the way. So although we didn't have, and I worked in this building when it was kind of new. So all this land up here is, this is the Mancos Valley. If you've driven, you know, between Durango and Cortez, you go through the Mancos Valley, beautiful valley. Tribe had 1868 winner's rights claims. Winner's decision took place before the turn of the century in the late 1900s. And the Supreme Court decided that Indian tribes are entitled to adequate water to fulfill the purposes of their reservation. So, and that, you know, that's when you're lodging a winner's right claim, that's how you have to make your argument, is that how are you going to, you know, how does this apply to the purposes of your reservation? Now, had what happened in this case, in the case of the Mancos River, which goes right through, you can see it goes right into and through the reservation, was the Bureau of Reclamation built Jackson Gulch Reservoir, did not include the tribe. And even though the Mancos River runs right through their reservation. And we found correspondence to that effect in the archives. And that was one of our, that was one of the strongest arguments that Ute Mountain Ute tribe had in the settlement. So if had the tribe exercised their 1868 claims, they theoretically could have dried up the Mancos Valley. All this irrigated, all this water would have belonged to the Ute Mountain Ute tribe. But I'm going to show you in some future photos the downside of that approach. First of all, it would have really changed life as we know it in the Mancos Valley. But the other part of it is when you get down on the Mancos River down on the reservation, doesn't offer a lot of good opportunities for agricultural development. Mancos River is not a huge river, fairly saline, and you're talking about a narrow canyon in a lot of places. So we studied it. You would have had to pump water up onto the benches, you know, in other words, you'd had to just to get it up to some place where you could use it for irrigation. So as a practical matter, not a great option, you know, to try and, I mean, it wouldn't be good for the people in the Mancos Valley, and it wouldn't do the tribe much good. So anyway, that was sort of the leverage that opened up the opportunity to get some other solutions. And so what happened is that these rights on the Mancos River were subordinated. In other words, they had an 1868 claim to all this water. They subordinated their claim to the date of the settlement, which was 1986 or 1988, I guess was when the legislation was, in exchange for water out of the Dolores Project. And I'm going to sort of describe what the tribe got out of the Dolores Project. And the reason why that, in terms of fulfilling the purposes of the reservation, I'm going to kind of sort of demonstrate how this particular solution worked. So for one thing, the community, has anybody ever been to Toyoc, to the Ute Mountain Ute community? Okay, great. Well, so there was never drinkable water in Toyoc. When I first went down there, when we were actually talking about the water rights settlement, there were stock tanks in people's front yards, and there was a water truck that would back in and fill these tanks. And then for cooking or drinking water, there was water piped in the house, but it was undrinkable. People would carry buckets of water inside, you know, to do their culinary work. And so one of the things that you know, that the water settlement did, let me see, get back to my little thing here. One of the things that the water, I got to get in the right place. That the water settlement did is that McPhee Reservoir, and you can't really see, it's right on the kind of on the bend of the Dolores River. There's a pipeline, domestic pipeline that was built that goes right through the Cortez treatment plant, right to Toyoc. And so the community got drinking water for the first time in their history. And it not only, as you'll see, not only did that result in water going to the households, but it created the economic development opportunities that are not there. If you think about trying to run a business without drinkable water, your opportunities are pretty limited. And then the other piece of it is this, these are center pivot sprinklers, 110 of them out here on this part of the, you know, kind of around the toe of Ute Mountain. If you know the geography, go past Toyoc and then around the toe. And that's where these lands are. And it turns out, this was the best place to get wet water to irrigate with. They were able to, they went through and carefully classified the land, you know, they classified the lands. We went and start, you know, I was, after I finished with the settlement work, then I was on the, I was project development coordinator. So we went out and looked at where the best place to put, you know, basically 7,700 acres of irrigated land would be. And so we took the soil classifications. We took the work that Reclamation had done. And then there's a lot of archaeology out there, huge archaeological discoveries when this was unearthed. You know, when, I mean, we would go out and have lunch. We'd be sitting next to great kivas and stuff out there having lunch. And so they would, they move the project, you know, the, we would, the pivots got moved around to be put on the best soils, but also to avoid the major archaeological sites. So that's the, so that's how these lands were selected, and they really are quite productive. And until we ran into severe water shortages, I'm going to talk about later, that, you know, the this farm worked really well. It's highly efficient, very productive, and profitable. So that part of fulfilling the purpose of the reservation, they had drinking water, they had water for economic development, and probably the best farm in this part of the country, in my estimation. Any questions up to this point? Yes. Okay, so the question is, what kind of crops are we growing? The most profitable crop has been alfalfa. And it's alfalfa that goes into the dairy market, you know, which is, again, the, you know, milk is really one of the backbones of the food chain. And so they're able to take the, for this high altitude hay is just, you know, high nutrition. In fact, they don't sell it by weight. They sell it by nutritional content. And so that's where it ends up, the alfalfa in the dairy market. The other thing that there have been a variety of other crops over the years. One of the things that is really important right now is corn, because as I'll demonstrate later, the tribe put together what's called a bow and arrow brand corn mill. And so they grow, I mean, they use some of these pivots to grow corn to run through the mill. And that, you know, that ended up employing another 15 people. Yes.
So there's also ranching operations that happen on the reservation, or does most of that feed get shipped?
Excellent question. So the, and I'm going to show you some photos. You'll get some images of this. So the tribe, they're individual tribal members that own cattle, and they, the tribe has ranches. They have five ranches in La Plata and Montezuma County. They have one up in Gunnison called Pinecrest. And then there's a, and so a lot of that cattle is individually owned, but then there's a tribal cow herd. And at its peak, the bow and arrow, it's also a bow and arrow brand. That's where that came from. That's been their brand forever. They about 650 head of really fine, well-bred cattle. And actually for the culturally, you know, for the people of Toyah, they've been livestock people forever. Farming is new. And although they've done really well at it, they've run a profitable, you know, been able to run a profitable farm, but their heart is in the livestock. I mean, everybody, whenever I do this presentation with the chairman, he takes the cattle part of it because that's kind of, that's where his heart is and everything. So real good question. We'll kind of delve into that a little bit more. Any other questions at this point? All righty. So I'm going to advance this. So here's the, I'm going to start with the domestic water, what's called M&I, municipal industrial water. They got 1,000 acre feet of water for drinking and economic development. And I've already told you the story about how all of a sudden people had really potable water piped right into their houses, a huge breakthrough. And since that time, there's been considerable housing expansion in Toyah, partly facilitated by having this, you know, available water supply. And then it also provided a clean, reliable water source for economic development. And so you can see, I don't know if you've driven down 491, you know, you go by the, you can see the casino, the RV park, the hotel, the travel center. None of that would have been possible without potable water. So that's one of the kind of economic development activities that came out of the settlement. The other thing that happened in conjunction with the settlement is the tribe formed Weemanooch Construction Authority. They formed a construction company, and that construction company, their first big job was to build the on-reservation, you know, canal and laterals, the on-reservation facilities. And they went on to build Lake Night Horse, most of the Animal Sulpata project. And as I was saying, I'm on the, you know, the enterprise board that I'm on. they're doing amazingly well. I mean, they just got a $41 million project for a municipal pipeline over on the Front Range. So that's the the economic development that came out of the settlement is really made a difference in economically and otherwise, and employment wise. So here's the, now I'm going to give you some images. So what you're looking at, this photo, I've got a pointer here for this. So these are some of the center pivot sprinklers. I mean, it's quite amazing. This is the headquarters down here. You can see these pivots going off into the background. And this is out in the desert, these beautiful verdant center pivot fields kind of in the middle of a desert. And then you can over here, this is the, you're asking about what's the main crop is, it's really alfalfa. This is the backside of the toe of Ute Mountain. In other words, you come around kind of on this side of the toe of the Ute. And so this is really kind of depicts, the hay production that they've been able to do. And their hay is so valued that even though they have, last year, I'm going to go into the hard part of the story, the shortage and everything. But their customers are going to stick with them. They haven't been able to supply all their customers because they haven't had the water to produce the hay. But they've got a really strong customer base. And it's done the whole economy of that part, Montezuma and Dolores counties. Lots of other people followed them into the dairy markets. They started growing corn. Lots of people followed with corn. So everybody in the beginning was worried, the tribe's going to have some kind of advantage. Well, actually, what has happened as a result of the tribal farm is a bunch of market opportunities have been opened up that other farmers have moved into. So it's actually been a pretty positive story for the whole region. So here's the cow part of it. This is so the bow and arrow brand cow herd, they summer on tribal rangelands. And then they were able, when the production is there, then they graze on alfalfa aftermath. In other words, there's considerable, let's say that out of the 7,600 acres, you got 4,000 or 5,000 acres of alfalfa. Those cattle can be brought in after the alfalfa has all been harvested, and they can really live off this aftermath really well. And so there's a couple of photos of just some of the mama cows, pretty characteristic of the herd. You can see them all lined up around the edges. So bow and arrow brand cornmeal. This happened in, was established in 2017 to create a value-added product. You can see people work, and this is a state-of-the-art cornmeal. And so they're, right now they were in a very expanding customer base. I mean, they're really kind of niche. They started on big retail, that didn't work. And so they have a much more niche-oriented market, but their demand is expanded steadily. And again, you're going to see that got constrained a bit by the drought just because of, not to say, yes, sir.
Is this located near the farms or where is it located?
Yes, it's right in, where I showed you the headquarters, that headquarters shot.
Yeah.
The mill is kind of right there. You can walk from the farm headquarters, and they have all bins, they have all their grain bins and everything, and some of those bins are devoted to corn. So yeah, it's kind of right across the way. And everybody loves, if you ever get a tour out there, everybody loves the cornmeal. You can't hear in there, but just being able to see it and then go outside and talk about it is really pretty outstanding. So yeah, the markets have been expanding. The mill has been profitable. It even made money while this farm has been struggling. And, the drought has put this at risk to some degree. So, the severe drought, and this is worst drought in 1,200 years. I mean, you've got a reference that you were given. A partner and I did a co-authored a paper on the San Juan Mountains. We used the 1990s as a baseline and compared that to the 20 years from 2000 to 2022. It's a grim story in terms of the reduction. I mean, and looked at year by year, season by season, and you can see what's happened. How much really the water supply has diminished in that 22 year period. So they only had nine of 110 center pivots for 2021. They kept 971 acres of alfalfa alive. They planted 231 acres of triticale, which is a forage. It's a cover crop, but also livestock uses it. And then, you know, they were just trying to do everything they can not to have to sell off the cow herd. And they've actually had to, they've sold off 150 of their 650 right now. And I guarantee you, when they get a chance, they're going to build it back up. So their unaudited net losses in 2021 are over $2 million. The farm employment decreased by 50% from 30 to 15 people. And the employment in the corn mill decreased from 12 to 9 people. So that those are some of the impacts of basically reduced water supply. If you don't have the water, you can't do the farming and you can't make the revenues. So how they've survived. First of all, the tribe has really tapped into all the farm programs that are available to any farmer. So they're very, you know, they had crop insurance and you know, there are drought payments and various things. So they tapped everything they could that way. The other thing that they've done strategically, you know, the management decided, Simon Martinez is actually the general manager. He said, okay, if we're not going to be able to fully produce and we want to use our crews as much as we can, we're going to take this opportunity to make the farm even more efficient than it is. I mean, it's gravity flow. It's got, you know, all center pivots, moisture probes, nutrient probes. They can operate all of those pivots remotely as they pick up information. And so they've already got a very efficient setup. So they said, we're going to make it better. I mean, while we're resting. While we're not able to fully produce. So they've started, they're replacing about 10 center pivot sprinklers a year with, you know, kind of cost share with NRCS. They're redoing all the nozzles to get optimal efficiency for the water supply. The crews are being used to install micro hydro units. In fact, that's one of, I mean, Manuel Hart might be with me today, but he's out there with the Commissioner of Agriculture. They just commissioned the first three micro hydro units. These are in the pipe laterals that serve their fields. They have little hydro units, and they're going to basically generate enough power. They've done three so far. They could do as many as a dozen, but it will power the corn mill. And it'll, you know, if you're trying to run all overnight shifts and all that, in other words, periods of high demand where power is really expensive, they're going to produce their own power. So they'll be able to run part of the pivots, all of the corn mill ultimately, eventually, and their headquarters with this micro hydro power. So pretty cool. And the first three, we didn't know. I mean, this is state of the art. And they commissioned all three of them here in the last couple of weeks, and darn if they didn't work. So that's why the commissioner's out there cutting ribbons and everything right now. So the other thing the crews are going to be able to do is to put in more sectionalizing valves. This is a very large, if you look at the whole spread of the project, you're talking about a lot of laterals going a lot of different places. And so the more they can sectionalize those laterals and direct the water, particularly in hard times, at where it's needed, and also being able to shut off water when they need to make a repair and keep the rest of the system running, that's what they're going to be doing over this winter, is building sectionalizing valves. So when the water comes back, Farmer Ranch is going to be stronger than ever in terms of their infrastructure and their ability to produce. So what are the other thing I would say is 6,000 fallowed acres, they're out there having to treat 6,000 acres that aren't producing anything to keep it in shape. And all that's being carefully monitored and evaluated. I mean, to see fallowing is unfortunately going to become more of a necessity in this part of the West. So what did they do to manage the fallow land? What did it cost? And then what kind of response did they get when they recropped it? And actually this fall, they're going to start putting some of the first fallowed lands back into production. The rains have really helped. Let me put it that way. So anyway, I already mentioned the efficiency improvements, new pivots, nozzles, sectionalizing valve, micro hydro power units. That's part of their strategy, is just being more efficient than they already are going forward. Water efficient crops. And so the corn was a move in that direction, less water intensive than alfalfa. They're looking at custom sunflowers. That's a European market. They've made good money in that market in the past. It uses about half of the water of alfalfa. And then they're also looking at hemp seed. There's been a big excitement about hemp production around. And what we figured out is that hemp seed, certified hemp seed, is the missing link. Nobody can get enough certified seed. Tribe has, the tribal farm has a really good history of seed production. These are isolated fields, not subject to cross-contamination. And so that's the other, they're looking at hemp seed production. And we should be starting to experiment with that as early as next year. And then there's food production. They're going to build a tribal grocery store, so they want some food production coming to that store. And the basic philosophy, of this, given the reality that they're, we don't know, they're not always going to have a full water supply, is what is the best return for the least amount of water? And so you add the value added corn mill, for example, you're getting more jobs, you're getting more income out of the, out of the amount of water that you use to irrigate that corn. And, same thing with sunflower, hemp, and the like. Any questions up to this point? Yes.
Hemp and sunflower are not for food products. They're just agricultural economic.
Well, the sunflowers are food.
Yeah.
Although some of it may be oil. Now, I can't really answer your question with a lot of knowledge. But, generally there is the sunflower market, eating sunflowers and then sunflower oil. But apparently they've done this before, and European markets were the hottest. And so they're going to try this again. I'm not going to go into a lot of details. The other thing that happened was that there was a 2000 amendment to the settlement. The tribe originally had, was the Animal Supply Project was originally going to serve more irrigated land on the Ute Mountain Ute Reservation. And also some non-Indian farmers, just like the Dolores Project did. And what happened for a variety of reasons, and I was not on the negotiating team at this point, but they were, the irrigation facilities got taken out of the project. They downsized the reservoir, they eliminated the irrigation component, and that left them with, and they made it strictly municipal industrial water. So they've got water sitting in Lake Nighthorse, but they really don't, without the infrastructure that was going to carry the water out onto the reservation to irrigate, they don't have any really way to get that water anywhere. There's no infrastructure existing. And there's a lot of restrictions on the use of the water. It has to be municipal industrial. 16,000 acre feet is, each tribe has that share, Southern Ute and Ute Mountain Ute. That's enough water to run the power plants up in Craig. So it's not like you can take a small, this is a lot of that water. And the contracts require them to, once they take that water, they have to pay some pretty substantial operation and maintenance charges in perpetuity. So that's just there's lots of challenges ahead with the ALP, and you'll probably be hearing about them. But that's certainly one of the things that, as a Water Resources Committee, we're trying to figure out. We do have, right now, we're just starting talks with people in Montezuma and La Plata counties and with the municipalities of Fortez and Mancos about their interest in possibly using some of this M&I water. So that's the first, and again, to trying to figure out who they can partner with, because water development is expensive. And, it's really, it's hard to go it alone in the water business. You really have to have multiple beneficiaries to make these things work financially. So that's one of the things that's being explored is, could they, yes, sir, ma'am.
My general overview of water project for tribal water. And then, I think it was about a few weeks ago, month in our local paper, there was an article about potentially taking water from Nighthorse, so it was part of Durango, drinking water. And so, and I guess I'm just, I wasn't clear on my broad stroke understanding what it was for tribal communities.
So really good, excellent question. So most of the water is, dedicated to the tribes, but there is additional water. State of Colorado has 10,000 acre feet that they purchased. And then the Animal Supply Conservancy District has an allocation. There are other allocations out there because they had the dry side. If you think about Hesperus and Fort Lewis Mesa and that area, they were going to be beneficiaries of the irrigation water as well. And they were thinking of a future where they had, where they could have domestic water to drink. So when the tribe lost their irrigation, so did everybody else. And so what's those areas, so what's happening is the attempt to at least get some domestic water out onto, out into that out on what's now known as the dry side. And so, and Lake Durango was always perpetually short of water. The whole reservoir was built by a developer and it wasn't sized to supply the whole community and everything. It's been taken over as a public entity, so it's much better run. So they're trying to beef up their supply, and that's a way, when you're building water infrastructure, you want to, if you're trying to get to point C, sometimes if you can get from point A to point B, then you're a lot closer to your goal. And so that's essentially what's happened, is that, you know, Lake Durango is going to receive and is actually going to be the beneficiary of some of this water. And it's all, I mean, this is all allowable under the contracts. And then ultimately, there's a La Plata West water company, and they're trying to really sell domestic taps kind of out there. Because the other thing that's happening out there with the drought and so forth is that what irrigation exists out there is really groundwater, and the groundwater is depleting and declining. And so it becomes even more important to have a source of domestic water. And then the other thing that would allow is if you're not relying on wells, then you can actually make your development, your housing development, a little more compact. You don't have to spread it out so that, you know, to accommodate a bunch of wells. So that's kind of where that's a real good question. Does that sort of answer it for you? And then there's a, I forget what the committee's called, but an operating group. And so the other party that got some of the water was the San Juan Water Commission. So some of this water is going down into New Mexico and being divvied up by the Water Commission. And it can be that there's two ways to get water out of the ALP, either out of the reservoir or out of the river. The river is the cheapest because anything that you're taking out of the reservoir is going to have pumping costs associated, you know, to get it from the Animas River up into Ridges Basin. Did you have any other question on that? Okay, good one. All right, so I'm glad I brought that up. I mean, so the Ute Reservation, these are other settlement things that lie ahead. And right now, most of our focus is on the new, on settlement. Yeah, I got my little deal here. Is down here, is settling the claims in the New Mexico, this state line, in this New Mexico part of the reservation. And it's, what's interesting, I mean, the main use is turning out to be renewable energy development. They've got abundant sunshine. They've got lots of open land down there in New Mexico. And then all the power grid that was built for the coal-fired power plants that are going away. Although I noticed that Farmers is actually trying to buy one of those power plants. But at any rate, all those transmissions, I mean, if you're trying to do renewable energy, you got to have the source, which is, you know, in this case, the sun. And then you got to have a wire to put it on. And there's just wires. I mean, everybody used the reservation for their infrastructure crossing. Well, that's actually turning out to be an advantage now. And let's see, I was going to mention one other thing about, and the other type of renewable project that they have that's water related in New Mexico is what's called a pump back storage project, which is essentially a hydro battery. In other words, you basically have two reservoirs, you pump water and they will use renewable power up to the top when it's available, when the sun's shining. And then when it gets dark and everybody's going home and firing up their appliances, there's what's called a green power gap. So you release that power, and it's a very, you know, beneficial grid operation tool. So that's one of their projects, and that's going to require, you know, some more. It's going to take 5,000 acre feet to initially fill that one. And all of these projects involve investors. I mean, they're too big. I mean, the pump back storage is $1 billion plus project. So it's really, you know, you've got to have investors involved. And that's one of the things we're doing in the Development Corporation, is to try to set up an energy company to manage all these renewable energy opportunities. And from what I can see is, and again, we're going to go into fine detail with feasibility and all that. This is probably really an important future opportunity, because the tribe has depended heavily on oil and gas revenues in the past. Those are going away. And actually, to replace that with substantial renewable development, I see as one of their most important opportunities. So Utah, I'm saying, when I did this slide, there were no talks yet. There's starting to be some talks. One of the biggest issues that are in, that complicates these talks, this is White Mesa, Utah. There's Blanding. The Energy Fuels, the only uranium milling operation in the United States, is right near there, White Mesa. And and they're actually starting to import waste. And so there's a lot of concerns about what that's going to do to groundwater over some period of time. So in addition to trying to secure water rights for, you know, because the White Mesa people, they have cattle and very, you know, they need domestic water and everything. But that's somewhat complicated by the fact that you have this water, potential water quality issue, and a fairly large company swinging a lot of weight in a pretty rural area. So that's the Utah situation. Any questions on those settlements? See, where am I? Okay. So, I guess what I would say and what we've learned really in given, it's always been true in the water world. I mean, I've been involved in it for a number of years, that nobody goes it alone. I mean, you really got to be collaborative and networking and working with all the various interests. And now that we're in this, 1200 year drought, it's even more. And, you know, the need to cooperate, communicate, problem solve is even more intense. So what's happened, first of all, the state of Colorado has actively engaged the tribes in Colorado Basin issues and provided ag water funding assistance from CWCB and the Department of Natural Resources. I was chairman of the Southwest Basin Roundtable for 12 years. This is really new territory. I mean, the opening to the tribes and really inviting them into all these funding sources and all of the negotiation going on in the basin. I mean, I just came from a meeting with the director of CWCB and their representative from the Attorney General's office. So this is very, very structured process. Discussions are starting to unfold. State legislature passed a Senate bill just this year, it's 22-105, that acknowledges the tribes as sovereign nations, and that is their status. They're, in other words, they're on a par with a state. In other words, they are not subservient to the state of Colorado. They're a sovereign, and that's one of the things we talked about over, after lunch today, was sovereign. How do we build the sovereign to sovereign relationship so that we make a really cool concept real? And then the tribes have been provided a seat on the board of Colorado Water Congress, which they appointed me to fill. But then the director of the general manager of Farmer Ranch Enterprise went up to Water Congress and he got appointed by their board. So all the doors are opening, for tribal participation in all of the water organizations. And it's really already been extremely beneficial. Not that we're not going to have a lot of hard discussions, a lot of hard issues to deal with. But in all of my experience, if people build underlying relationships and know each other and understand each other and can communicate with each other, even the most difficult problems become easier to solve. And that's kind of where we're at, is really working on personal, developing really solid relationships and making quite a bit of progress. So I guess this is my closing theme, is we're all in this together. And if Manuel Hart, the chairman, was here, this would be his message too. I mean, he's a big proponent of this. So first of all the challenges the tribes face in managing drought impacts, locally and within the basin, have made it clear that we've got to all work together. The tribes benefit from the support of Becky Mitchell, and that's who we were meeting with earlier this afternoon. She's not only the director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, but Becky is our Upper Colorado River Commissioner. So there's a commission that governs the four upper basin states and makes determinations about how they jointly manage the upper basin share of the water. And so so Becky has really opened the door. I went to the annual meeting of the Colorado River Basin entities last winter, and Becky was there and the commission was there, and she came forward and said what she was doing to open participation to the Ute Mountain Ute tribe. And she turned and asked the other three states, what are you doing? And they've actually cleaned, you know, actually made some progress. I mean, she put them on the spot right there. So we've got our, you know, kind of our state, I think, setting a really good example that way. Our Colorado senators and governor, state legislators, they're always there to help us. I mean, the, you know, Senator Bennett, Senator Hickenlooper, you know, I mean, Kate Greenberg, Commissioner of Agriculture, is out, you know, stay help with the microhydro units. That's why, you know, they're out there touring those right now. So really good support from, you know, from our federal representatives, from the governor and the state. And then the tribes have been welcome into the water community. The chairman made a presentation, and Lorelei Cloud from Southern Ute, they jointly made a presentation on April 1st to, this is the biggest water meeting in our area. It's called Southwest Water Conservation District Seminar. And they made presentations and made a really big impression. I mean, I had been a roundtable chair. I'd been a water manager for 12 years. I know all these people. And once the tribes came forward and said, hey, we're going to protect our rights. We, you know, we're entitled to these rights. We're going to protect them. But we realize that we've got to work together to make that happen. That this is difficult circumstances. And people came up to me after that and said, man, we didn't realize the depth of, you know, kind of the role of the tribe. And so that sort of reset the tone here locally as well. You know, we've been having regular meetings with Southwestern Water Conservation District and thinking about laying kind of what the tribe's challenges are and thinking about how we can work together and keep each other whole. So that's kind of I guess that's my closing theme, is that we're all in this together, and it's going to be an interesting ride going forward. Are there any other questions? Yes.
So where does New Mexico stand on acknowledging tribal water rights and incorporating that into state management?
So it's interesting, is that they're willing, you know, they're ready to negotiate. The problem with New Mexico is there's not much water down there. I mean, there's the San Juan River. And one of the things, by the way, so the Mountain Ute tribe has a 1,600 acre foot, 1868 priority right, ag right out of the San Juan River. And that's one of the projects we're working on right now, is really tapping that water right. So that's what we've got available. There's going to be water freed up by the power plants, you know, but that's all really high level stuff. I mean, we don't know where all that's going, but that's a possibility. But beyond that, all there is groundwater, and generally groundwater that's not connected to a stream. In other words, it's independent groundwater. And we're focusing a lot on surface water because the groundwater is really expensive to even try to figure out if it's there. In other words, if you're going to try to, you know, if you want to make beneficial use of groundwater, you've got to figure out, okay, where are you going to use it? What do you need it for? How much do you need? Then you got to drill a test well to see if the water is there. And these test wells can cost millions of dollars. So that's the big complexity within New Mexico, is really, how do we craft a settlement given those, you know, if we're being limited to groundwater, it's going to be, you know, very challenging. But we are, again, we're looking at all options. So fairly pretty friendly. I mean, they're open. New Mexico would like to settle. I mean, they're saying, yeah, we want to get this done. And they've got other water rights that they're trying to settle. I mean, the San Juan goes right through northern New Mexico. So they'd love to get things kind of cleared up in New Mexico. So, but we're very early in these negotiations. And like I said, you know, the groundwater feasibility piece of it, we have not figured that one out yet, or it's going to be really expensive. We have a water well out there that was actually created in a field that we may be able to tap into and test. Still not going to be cheap, but we're just trying to find a place to start on that. Good question. Any other questions? Anybody from CSU have any questions? All right. Well, I think that, yes, all right.
You did sort of address it before and ask you that, but what do you think it is about Colorado that has us ahead of the other three states in the Southwest as far as bringing these tribal voices to the table? Is it just kind of a political climate issue, or why do you think Utah and New Mexico lag behind it?
Well, so New Mexico has a lot of tribes. I mean, it's a fairly complex picture. So one of the benefits, for the Colorado tribes is that there's just two tribes. So that's one thing. But I think it's more the other thing that you're alluding to. I just think that there is people's hearts are in the right place. I mean, when you get for example, the law that I talked to that just acknowledging tribal sovereignty, one of the state senators that's retiring came to Manuel Hart and said, "What can I do for you? How can we help you?" And he said, "Acknowledge our sovereignty as a, you know," and they passed the legislation. So, and then, you know, you've got the other thing about Colorado is you have the Water Conservation Board, you have the water roundtables. There's a lot more democracy in Colorado around water, and there's lots of lawyers too. I mean, a lot of legalities and everything. So I think that's really the openness.
So there is no analog for New Mexico and Utah to that Water Conservation Board?
Not that I'm aware of. Jennifer Gimbel may know. She used to run the Water Conservation Board. But so Colorado has a very well-established, transparent kind of water management setup. And bringing it right on down to the roundtable level. I mean, Southwest Colorado is nine, it's not a basin. Most basins have a main stem with tributaries. We have nine sub-basins. Eight of them flow out of state before they join, seven of them actually flow into the San Juan River. And then the Dolores turns north and goes directly into the Colorado. And so having that process, having the combination of the Water Conservation Board and then the roundtables, where you really democratize and you're really getting down, you know, to the grassroots level, I think is what makes change possible and adaptation and openness. There's just a whole lot more communication going on and good political leadership. Our two senators, I wouldn't trade them for anybody, actually. Are there, yes?
Along with the slide, but I appreciate hearing that there's openness and this welcoming spirit, because I mean the Bureau of Reclamation has this mandate, I don't think it's more just a recommendation to reduce the 30%, right, the water usage. So massive shared, how we all reduce. And meanwhile there's been this historic injustice in tribes not having any. And so I guess I'm just thinking the water community is embracing this idea that in the context of a lot of people using less, there is the realm for these tribal groups to need to get more.
Yeah, so if you didn't hear that, just to repeat the question or the statement is, so there's all this collaboration, all this cooperation, but are the tribes really kind of getting their share? And you're raising a very real issue, because what is happening right now, and we were just discussing this a couple hours ago, is that the tribes hold about 25% of the water rights in the Colorado River Basin. And there's, I think I threw out a statistic earlier about the unallocated water rights. That water that is not has not been developed by the tribes is still in the river and is being used by other parties, and it's ending up in Lake Powell and so forth. So one of the big, discussions that we were having this morning, so like in the lower basin, they're actually paying people to forego use of water. California is, they've been overusing for a long time. And so they're going to cut back and everybody wants to be paid for that. Well, the tribes have been, they've been cut out for a long time and have not received any compensation. So that's you're putting your finger on a really, really critical issue. How are they going to be able to exercise their share of the Colorado River water? And some of it, and a lot of it is going to take, the legislation and all the infrastructure money that is suddenly available could help, because that's, if you have a right and you have a use, you got to have infrastructure to connect that water rate to where you want to use it. And so I think that that's one of the main, if people are going to make good on their commitment to cut the tribes into their entitled share of water, people are going to have to get behind some major infrastructure investments so the tribes can access their water and make use of it. So, yeah, excellent statement and good question. Anything else? Well, this has been, yes.
Mike, this is Jennifer. We're going to dismiss our class here, but I wanted to thank you very much for your presentation. It was excellent.
Well, thank you very much, Jennifer, and it's good to hear you again. Hey, Jennifer and I are on the Water Congress board together, so we crossed paths again recently. Used to when Jennifer ran CWCB, yeah, she was go-to, and so great to see you in academia, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thanks, right. Caitlin. We're going to check off here.
All right.
Thank you so much for coming to
And I know, too, you're running between other watermen.
And meeting for all.